You are listening to Long Innings, brought to you by Cricket Next.
Welcome to Long Innings. You're with me, Supriya, and this is brought to you by Cricket Next. And on today's podcast, let's look at the history of cricket post-World War II.
On this episode of Long Innings, we take a look at the history of cricket post-World War II, Part 1.
In the last podcast, we had covered cricket up till World War II. In this podcast, we continue cricket's journey after World War II. The last test before the Second World War was between England and West Indies in August 1939, and after that, there was no test cricket for nearly 7 years due to World War II. Just like the situation in World War I, cricket in India continued. However, in countries like Australia, England, South Africa, West Indies and New Zealand, first-class cricket was suspended for some or nearly the entire duration of the war, and a small number of ad hoc first-class matches were organised whenever possible. The first test after the conclusion of World War II was between New Zealand and Australia at Wellington in March 1946, in which Australia emerged victors by an innings and 103 runs. The war had interrupted or even prematurely ended the career of some cricketers, and people, for the most part, were glad to see the resumption of cricket. In 1948, a strong Australian team, led by Don Bradman, toured England and decimated the hosts 4-0 in the five-test series. This team was called the Invincibles and is considered one of the finest test teams ever. Bradman scored 508 runs in the series at a batting average of 72.57 and was out for a duck in his last innings, which left him 4 runs short of 7,000 test runs and a batting average of 99.94, just agonizingly short of 100. In the fourth test at Headingley in Leeds, Australia became the first team to chase a target in excess of 400 in the fourth innings, and Bradman contributed to the win with an imperious unbeaten 173. After this tour, Bradman retired from test cricket, and the game of cricket lost one of its greatest ever players. In October 1952, Pakistan became the seventh team to play test cricket when they toured India. They lost their inaugural test by an innings and 70 runs, and India won the five-test series 2-1, which was their first ever test series win. In March 1954, the great Garfield Sobers made his debut for West Indies against England at Kingston, Jamaica. In spite of Bradman's phenomenal achievements as a cricketer, many critics consider Sobers as the greatest cricketer of all time. He was an all-rounder whose batting alone was good enough for him to be considered as an all-time great. One of Australia's finest captains, Ian Chappell, rates him as the best batsman he had ever seen. Sobers was also capable of bowling left-arm fast as well as left-arm orthodox and left-arm Chinaman styles of bowling. To add to this impressive resume, he was also a brilliant fielder, particularly in the slips. He was a multidimensional cricketer capable of excelling in various disciplines in cricket and was popular amongst his peers. In 1958, Sobers scored his maiden test century against Pakistan at Kingston and converted it into an unbeaten 365, thereby breaking Len Hutton's record for the highest individual score in tests. On 31st August 1968, Sobers became the first cricketer to hit 6 sixes in an over in first-class cricket. He achieved this feat when he captained Nottinghamshire against Glamorgan, and the unfortunate bowler was Malcolm Nash. Sobers went on to break many records in his illustrious career. In 93 tests, Sobers scored 8,032 runs at a batting average of 57.78 and also took 235 wickets and 109 catches. Towards the late 1950s, it was felt in some circles that cricket had lost a bit of its charm, and when West Indies toured Australia in 1960-61, their respective captains in Frank Worrell and Richie Beno promised to play an attractive and entertaining brand of cricket in a bid to win back the cricketing public. The first test in Brisbane was one of the most exciting ever and was the first ever tied test in history. Australia clinched the series 2-1 with a 2-wicket victory in the fifth test at Melbourne, and the exhilarating cricket reinvigorated the cricketing public's interest in test cricket. Until that point, there was only one version of cricket that was played around the world, and that was first class at the domestic level and test cricket at the international level. The first official List A match was between Lancashire and Leicestershire in May 1963 in a preliminary round of the Gillette Cup. Both sides batted for 65 overs and bowlers were restricted to a maximum of 15 overs. The number of overs per side in a List A match was between 40 to 60. Currently, a List A match includes ODI cricket between nations, other international matches of around 50 overs, the premier one-day competitions in each country, and matches involving a curtailed number of overs between a touring test team against main first-class teams. This once again proved to be a much-needed injection to infuse more life into cricket. In January 1971, the first 3 days of a test at the Melbourne Cricket Ground were washed out due to rain. Officials decided to abandon the game and play a one-off ODI game of 40 eight-ball overs. Australia won the game by 5 wickets and the game was played by the players of both teams in white kits and with a coloured ball. The new form of the game captured the imagination of the cricketing public, and the first ever Men's World Cup was held in England in 1975. Surprisingly, the first ever Women's World Cup was held 2 years before the men's in 1973. The first ever ODI World Cup for men proved to be an unqualified success, with West Indies beating Australia by 17 runs in the final, which was held on the longest day of the year, on 21st June 1975. ODI cricket was here to stay, and from that year onwards, a World Cup was played every 4 years. Up until the mid-1970s, while there had been a number of great fast bowlers in Test cricket, most of them hunted in pairs or at most 3 fast bowlers in a Test team, and there used to be some respite in the form of spinners. November 1975, West Indies toured Australia for a 6-test series that would unofficially decide the best Test team in the world. During that series, Australia fielded Geoff Thompson and Dennis Lilly, who formed a very formidable partnership. Thompson was at his quickest and was one of the fastest bowlers ever, and along with Lilly, wreaked havoc on the West Indian batting. The visitors were blown away 5-1 in the Test series. In the third Test between the West Indies and India at the Queen's Park Oval in Port of Spain in Trinidad in 1976, the West Indian captain, Clive Lloyd, declared and set India a target of 403. His attack consisted of just 2 fast bowlers and 3 spinners, who proved to be ineffective against the Indian batsmen, and India triumphed by 6 wickets. This led to a disillusionment of spinners by Lloyd, and with the battering of his batsmen by the Aussie quicks still fresh in his mind, he decided to form a 4-pronged pace attack for the future. He reasoned that if an Australian attack that contained 2 fast bowlers could inflict so much destruction, then his West Indies team that included 4 top-quality pace bowlers would be unbeatable. This was his blueprint for the future, and with the decline of top-quality spin in the middle to late 1970s, there was a great deal of emphasis placed by all test-playing nations to groom and develop top-class fast bowlers in their ranks. This led to the formation of the famed West Indian Pace Quartet that caused terror in the minds of many international batsmen and prematurely ended the careers of many top batsmen. There was a general disquiet among cricketers that they were not being paid enough money that their talents merited. As business magnate Kerry Packer wished to acquire the exclusive television rights to Australia's Test matches in 1976. However, the Australian Cricket Board, ACB, refused to accept his bid, and the rights were held by the Australian Broadcasting Commission, ABC. A miffed Packer set up his own series by secretly signing agreements with leading players from Australia, England, South Africa, Pakistan, and West Indies. 2 of the leading cricketers who played a role in recruiting cricketers from various countries included Ian Chappell and Tony Greig, who later on became broadcasters in Packer's Channel 9 after retirement. When Australia arrived to tour England in 1977, as many as 13 out of their tour squad of 17 had committed to Packer's proposal. And when news of the proposed tournament became public, a lot of vitriol was heaped on Tony Greig, who was England's cricket captain, and the British media dubbed it the Packer Circus. Greig was stripped of the English captaincy, and even though he retained his place as a player, he was ostracized by everyone in the cricket establishment. There was a great likelihood that all Packer players would be banned from Test and first-class cricket. Cricket's governing body, the ICC, International Cricket Council, now entered the controversy, which was initially perceived as an Australian domestic problem. Packer backed a challenge by 3 English cricketers, Greig, John Snow and Mike Proctor, who challenged the TCCB, Test and County Cricket Board, in court. The case began on 26th September 1977 and lasted 7 weeks. The ICC's lawyers said that if top players deserted international cricket, then gate receipts would decline. Packers lawyers said that the ICC had tried to force the players signed by Packer to break their contracts and prevent others from joining them. Justice Slade said in his judgment that professional cricketers needed to make a living and that it was wrong of the ICC to stand in the players' way just because its own interests might be damaged. He said that this was stretching the concept of loyalty too far and ordered the cricketing authorities to pay court costs, which added further insult to injury. By 1979, the ACB was in desperate financial straits and was faced with the prospect of fighting an opponent who had seemingly bottomless cash resources. In March 1979, Packer instigated a series of meetings with the chairman of the ACB, Bob Parrish, and they hammered out an agreement on the future of Australian cricket. When Parrish announced a truce on 30th May 1979, a surprise was in store for followers of the game. Channel 9 had won the exclusive rights to telecast Australian cricket. World Series cricket changed the game in many ways. Due to the punishing schedule, cricketers had to be fitter than before. Night matches became common in most countries and ODI cricket became the most popular form of the game. Players became full-time professionals and were well paid in most countries. Since most of the money was through television rights, broadcasters began to have a huge say in the running of the game. Most people agreed that Packer's actions ultimately did a lot of good for the game. Another major controversy in the early years of ODI cricket occurred in the Benson and Hedges World Series of Cricket in 1980-81. It was a best-of-five finals with the New Zealand vying for the trophy against Australia. The series was tied at one apiece and in the third final, New Zealand needed 6 runs to tie the match with 1 ball remaining. The Aussie captain Greg Chappell instructed his brother Trevor to roll the ball underarm along the ground to prevent New Zealand from scoring the 6 runs they needed to tie the match. At that time, the underarm action was legal, though it was considered against the spirit of cricketing fair play. As a result of this incident, underarm bowling was banned in international cricket by the ICC. It had been a long journey, but cricket continued to soldier on and develop as an international game in spite of the controversies that had occurred.
This podcast was brought to you by Cricket Next. Thanks for tuning in.